Hi, Patrick Cox here in the World Newsroom in Boston, and this is The World in Words number 38. As I speak, we're a few hours into the age of Globama, the Globamic era. And to mark this, we have an instant take from a linguist on the inaugural address. Also, what's going to happen to the phrase war on terror? That and a brilliant hybrid word courtesy of French and Arabic.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
It's embarrassing when Europeans come over here. They all speak English, and then we go over to Europe, and all we can say is, merci beaucoup.
Як шамаш?
Change, Borat, change. The World is co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. The Big Show is broadcast on more than 250 public radio stations around the United States. You can also hear The Big Show online at theworld.org. Today, we have three hits related to Barack Obama and language. First, the take on Obama's first speech as president from a linguist's point of view. Then we say goodbye, probably, to the term war on terror. Then we consider hope. Hope about language learning. The hope that with a new president, looking outward, that more Americans will learn a second language. And then finally, we have a very nice example of our eating sideways segment out of Algeria.
Hello there, this is The World's Alex Gallivant. I've stolen the language conch from Patrick just briefly because I wanted to tell you about a short extra podcast, a little mini podcast that you'll currently find online at theworld.org. It features a selection of international poets, or rather poets from around the world, who are reading selections of their work that they have deemed appropriate for the inauguration of President Obama. So if you enjoyed or didn't enjoy Elizabeth Alexander's poem at the inauguration ceremony itself, then you'll find four poems from different parts of the world, including Estonia and Kenya, online at theworld.org/poets.
Okay, first, it's a new dawn in Washington. Well, dawn took place, I guess, at noon today. It was high noon when Barack Obama became President Obama. We devoted pretty much the entire Big Show to the inauguration. Here was one of the things we did. We asked Mark Lieberman to identify some of the most interesting words and phrases in President Obama's speech. Lieberman is a professor of phonetics at the University of Pennsylvania, and here he is speaking with the Big Show's Lisa Mullins.
After listening to the speech, my first impression is that it was very much the speech of someone who was once a community organizer. We have phrases like, starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. From the point of view of connections to foreign policy and the rest of the world, one of the most interesting paragraphs from a linguistic point of view was the one that began, to the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect.
In fact, let's hear from Barack Obama right now.
To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect. To those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West, know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you destroy. To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist.
A powerful sentiment there, seemingly directed not only at the Muslim world, but also possibly at the previous George W. Bush administration. What did you hear, though?
What I thought was linguistically most interesting was the question of which leaders and which peoples are being addressed in the three sentences of that paragraph. The first is very plain. It's the Muslim world, and he seeks a new way forward based on mutual interest and respect. Then there are two more sentences, leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West. That could be Chavez in Venezuela. It could be the leadership of North Korea, but I think most Americans will take it as a continuation of the preceding sentence as referring to Islamist anti-Americanism, whether from governmental leaders or other popular leaders. And then the third sentence, similarly, those who cling to power through corruption, deceit, and the silencing of dissent know that you're on the wrong side of history. Again, this could apply to regimes all around the world that don't permit freedom of expression or that foster corruption. But I think that most Americans will probably relate that to the Muslim world.
I want to find out your impression of another sentiment from President Obama today from his speech. Let's hear this now.
As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake.
We will not give them up for expedience's sake. And also the use of the term generations, which he used many, many times during this speech. The two together, how do you read them?
That segment of the speech is as clear and unambiguous a repudiation of policies of torture and extraordinary rendition as practiced by the previous administration as would have been possible consistent with the politeness of discourse required in a speech of that kind. As for the appeal to generations past, throughout the speech, the theme is absolutely of a return to past values, looking forward to the future.
Did you hear any particular wording that you think will kind of live through the ages and become emblematic of Barack Obama?
I think it's awfully soon to try to judge. There are here and there in the speech some phrases that might wind up chiseled into marble someday, depending on what happens in the world in consequence. If, for example, his appeal to us to pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America really turns into a transformative change, then those will be words, I think, that people will remember for a long time. If that's not what happens, then I think they may not be remembered other than ironically.
Mark Lieberman. He's a professor of phonetics at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a founder of one of the very best blogs on language called Language Log. Okay, now, curmudgeon corner, and I am the curmudgeon. Don't get me wrong, I'm as excited as anyone else about the prospect of renewal down there in Washington. But I have had it up to here with the news media ramming the moment down my throat. Just listen to these headlines from a few of the papers. New York Times, on eve of history, Obama follows low-key path. Washington Post, Obama steps to door of White House and history. London Times, Washington waits for Barack Obama to deliver words to define history. Even China's Xinhua news agency got in on the act. They have a couple of reporters camped in a certain village in Africa, along with thousands of other news outlets. Here's their headline. Kenyan village awaits Obama's historic inauguration. I could go on. I will a little bit. Here's the Toronto Star, which offers a consumer's DIY for the day. Their headline, how to witness history. The Tehran Times, though, bucks the trend. Here's their headline. The Bush torture is finally over. Okay, I'm stepping back from curmudgeon corner. Happy face. Back to Washington, where the linguistic landscape is changing in all manner of ways. Here, for example, is a phrase that looks like it's going out of fashion. War on terror. But even if the Obama White House doesn't use those words, does that in and of itself actually change anything? Here's a story The Big Show's Matthew Bell reported just 4 days before the inauguration.
President Bush brought the phrase war on terror to life 9 days after the September 11th attacks. He has said it a lot since then. But last night, during his primetime farewell address as commander-in-chief, he never uttered the expression.
As the years passed, most Americans were able to return to life much as it had been before 9/11. But I never did. Every morning, I received a briefing on the threats to our nation. I vow to do everything in my power to keep us safe.
The president's omission of the phrase war on terror might have been an acknowledgement of just how controversial some of his counterterrorism policies have been. Eric Rosenbach is an international affairs expert at Harvard.
I think that the president probably dropped the term because it's been one of the phrases that people have used to identify him as being out of touch about the most intelligent way to combat extremism and to address the threat of terrorism against the United States.
Barack Obama has used the phrase war on terror, at least on the campaign trail. But he also says that things are going to be different after January 20th when it comes to defending the country from its terrorist enemies. Part of that might be a change in rhetoric. Yesterday, for example, Mr. Obama's nominee for Attorney General, Eric Holder, never used the expression. He condemned some of the most reviled aspects of President Bush's war on terror. Holder said waterboarding is torture. He said Guantanamo will be closed. But he was also clear when Republican Senator Lindsey Graham asked him this question.
Is it fair to say that we're at war, in your opinion?
I don't think there's any question but that we are at war. And I think, to be honest, I think our nation didn't realize that we were at war when, in fact, we were. When I look back at the 90s and the 10s and the embassy bombings, the bombing of the coal, I think we as a nation should have realized that at that point we were at war. We should not have waited until September the 11th of 2001 to make that determination.
I'm almost ready to vote for you right now.
By way of comparison with one of the United States' most important allies, the British government has already abandoned the phrase war on terror. British Foreign Secretary David Miliband says the phrase has been counterproductive.
The idea of the war on terror was a response that reflected the magnitude of the threat posed after 9/11. It did dramatize the nature of the threat. But actually, the more you look at it, the more you realize that it runs the risk of bringing together disparate interests, of giving preeminence to a military response. And that's why I think we've learned over the last 7 years the right way to recognize the fight against terrorism is to locate it in the economic, the political, as well as the security context that is so important.
In other words, treat terrorism first and foremost as a law enforcement problem, not a military one. But don't expect the U.S. to stop trying to kill al-Qaeda operatives, for example, in places like Pakistan. Again, Harvard's Eric Rosenbach.
Law enforcement is a very important aspect of counterterrorism because you want to bring terrorists to justice in a way that actually lands them in jail rather than the purgatory of Guantanamo Bay, but that you also need to use the tools that are part of intelligence and military special operations that allow you to take bad guys off the street.
And when that means using lethal force, as Barack Obama has said he will use when necessary, it's likely to be done under the legal framework of war. So the phrase war on terror might begin to disappear from the official rhetoric, but not from U.S. policy. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
There's something else that might stick around despite U.S. policy. And that is Americans' lack of interest in learning a second language. Not all Americans, by any means. But overall, the stats are pretty poor. However, often when a new president takes office, there's a renewed push for more language learning. We know that's likely to happen again. The Obama people are known to favor such a push of their own. In fact, you heard it from the man himself at the top of this podcast. George Bush tried it too. Listen to this.
Learning a language, somebody else's language, is a kind gesture. It's a gesture of interest. It really is a fundamental way to reach out to somebody and say, I care about you.
That was after 9/11, when it suddenly became clear that language learning was a national security priority. Here's The Big Show's Katie Clark reporting on a federally funded initiative that got a new lease of life after 9/11, and it may get a new one again in the Obama era.
Michael Long runs the School of Languages, Literatures, and Cultures at the University of Maryland at College Park. He says some 4,000 students study more than 20 different languages at the school, but that's not all.
We have a brand new PhD in second language acquisition program following the trend towards less commonly taught languages here. We're specializing in the acquisition and teaching of those languages, among other things, especially at advanced levels. We have a residential immersion facility. We have the Center for Advanced Study of Language, where they're doing a lot of interesting research. And we have an absolutely stellar linguistics department.
Long says part of this emphasis on languages comes in response to the September 11th attacks. But even before 9/11, there was talk of establishing something called the National Flagship Language Initiative. The initiative is a partnership between the federal government and higher education to produce fluent speakers in languages deemed critical to national security. Those include Arabic, Korean, Persian, Chinese, and Russian. The University of Maryland was selected to help set up the program at a handful of campuses across the country. The University of Maryland's Catherine Doughty says the overall goal is to teach students how to speak the languages like natives.
The idea is that when students come out of this program, they can take a job in the federal government and do the job in the foreign language. Prior to this, what would happen is the federal government would hire people who have other job skills, and then they would send them for language training.
But it's not just for future diplomats and intelligence officers. The flagship program is also training people for careers in international law and business, among others. Students in the two-year intensive program spend a lot of their time overseas. They also do internships at foreign companies and non-governmental organizations. Mike Long says the typical language program does little more than prepare graduates to be tourists.
They couldn't go and practice law or international relations in the language 24 hours a day, and yet that's the kind of thing we're looking to do with the students in these programs.
The University of Maryland is also looking at students' aptitude for certain languages. Catherine Doughty says no one knows, for instance, if someone who speaks Hebrew as a second language is more likely to be able to pick up Arabic than someone who studied Spanish.
If you can try to predict through various ways who's going to succeed, you can save time and money.
The jury's still out on whether the flagship program will do much to improve the way Americans interact with the rest of the world, let alone whether it will help improve national security.
I'm optimistic that it's a first and good step.
Juliet Kayyem is a terrorism expert at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.
If you look at, for example, the war in Iraq, I mean, what is the insurgency? And how are they forming, and who are these people? And these are questions that, from a security perspective, we should be able to answer. And a lot of these communities are talking on websites, communicating with each other in the cafes. We need to be able to be actually part of that dialogue to figure out what, in fact, is happening in these other countries.
And Kayyem says that's going to take a lot more than studying Arabic 101, let alone Spanish, French, or German. For The World, this is Katie Clark.
We're going to pick up on a couple of those languages Katie mentioned for this week's Eating Sideways segment. Eating Sideways is the name I've given to foreign words and phrases that defy easy translation. It's all explained in The World in Words number 31. The languages in question for this week are Arabic and French. In Algeria, Arabic and French are often spoken hybrid style, and that is where this word came from. Ha'et East. This is a combo of an Arabic word, ha'et, which means wall, and the French suffix East, as in artiste. And when these two elements are combined, they describe a certain type of young Algerian man who's short of work, he's bored, maybe he's a little menacing, and so he spends a lot of time out in the street leaning against walls. I remember doing that sort of thing as a kid. I was very good at looking bored and very bad at looking menacing. One last thing before I go. A friend emailed me this week from the Sundance Film Festival in Park City. She said that a local cab driver had told her that festival attendees are called PIBS, P-I-B-S, PIBS, people in black. Isn't that great? I can hear the dispatcher now. 3 PIBS on 2nd and Washington awaiting pickup. I think this acronym is a strictly Park City thing. I Wikipedia'd it, and I didn't find much there, apart from the fact that PIB is also the acronym for gross domestic product, GDP, if you say it in French or Spanish or Portuguese or Romanian. There's also a Norwegian metalcore band called PIB, which in this case, of course, stands for Purified in Blood. I mean, what else could they be called? Purified in Blood, you'll be sad to learn, broke up in 2007, partly because several of the band members have decided no longer to follow the vegan straight edge lifestyle. Maybe they stop being people in black, too. That's it for this week. Send me your comments, your suggestions for Reading Sideways, your ideas for stories I should cover. Post them at the Facebook group, The World in Words, or email me. That address is language@pri.org. Till next week.